The date today is March 27th, 2004. This is Dave Adelson speaking with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. And I thought we'd start off just simply if you could talk a little bit about your own background with the CIA and also possibly what you've been doing since you left the CIA.
Sure. I'm Ray McGovern. I came down to Washington in 1963. I was one of those folks that responded to John Kennedy's challenge to see what we might be able to do for our country rather than what our country might be able to do for us. I was an officer in the Army at the time, having been commissioned out of ROTC. And after I finished my active service, since my major in graduate as well as undergraduate school was Russian studies, and since I had heard about this new agency, which was tasked with the challenge of analyzing what the Soviets were up to, I applied for and landed a job as an analyst of Soviet foreign policy with the CIA, and that was in 63-64.
So during the course of your CIA career, what kind of responsibilities were you tasked with?
I initially was an analyst of Soviet foreign policy, specifically policy toward China and the international communist movement and Southeast Asia. Since this was Vietnam time, that was a very active account, and I had a very large responsibilities for the length of service that had been there. Later, as the years went by, I became chief of that branch. Then my responsibilities widened. I ended up being one of the daily briefers who go down to the White House, State Department, Defense Department, Pentagon, and the Vice President's office to share the President's daily brief one-on-one with the principals. I did that for 4 years during the years of Ronald Reagan and his senior leaders. And before that, I also participated in and actually chaired a number of national intelligence estimates, which have come very much into public discussion with respect to the abortion that was called a National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq, done in September and October of 2002. I probably should just backtrack just a little bit to remind people that the CIA was set up in 1947 by the National Security Act for two main purposes. One was so that there would never be a Pearl Harbor, another one. And to prevent that, you needed one central place, therefore Central Intelligence Agency, one central place in possession of all the information, whether it comes from the Army, Navy, Air Force, overhead photography, intercepted communications, embassies, bars, wherever, agents, that information needed to come into the, in those days, inbox of one person who was responsible and accountable for looking at that and making sure that he or she gleaned what policymakers needed to know about that information and put it in readable form in a succinct way so that policymakers would read it the next morning. So that was one major objective of the CIA. The other one was that there'd be a place in government that could tell the truth without fear or favor. There'd be a place in government not subservient to the State Department having to defend policy, not subservient to the Defense Department having to make the Soviets out to be 10 feet tall, but one place where the President of the United States could go and say to his director, look, I want you to tell me what you and your experts really think, okay? What you really think. I don't care what the State Department says. I don't care what the Defense Department says. I want to know what you really think. This is what I'm thinking of doing. I want your reaction to this, and I want it tomorrow, and I want it pure and simple, and I want it without fear or favor. Now, you can imagine what an asset that is to orderly policymaking if the president has that kind of resource to tap in making sensible policy. And that, of course, is the tragedy of what's happened over the last 2 years. That process has been corrupted. In any case, those are the two main reasons for the CIA. Most other people think about the more catchy TV, movie-type things where what we call covert action is glorified. That is sort of an ancillary function of the CIA. That also comes in that same National Security Act of 1947, but it comes in a sort of tacked-on phrase that says, the CIA shall perform such other duties as the President and the National Security Council shall from time to time direct. Okay. Now, why was that? Well, that was because here it is, 47. The Soviets are overrunning Eastern Europe. We had this incredible asset during the war, the Office of Strategic Services. It did wonderful things in the European and Asian theaters. Were we just going to disband that, or were we going to keep the capability to combat, to counter the KGB and other secret services? Well, obviously, we couldn't let it go by the board. And so that was tacked on as a way for the president to do these covert things. And the place they put it was the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, in a real sense, that's a structural fault, because one director is responsible for doing that kind of covert action and analyzing, in some cases, the results of that or the prospects for success for that covert action. So it takes a very strong director to overcome that schizophrenia and still perform his major service, which is his duty by statute of being the principal intelligence advisor to the President of the United States.
Well, following on that idea of the schizophrenia, am I correct that the functions of analysis and the operational functions are separated bureaucratically?
Yes, they're very separate. They're almost hermetically sealed off from one another, with one exception, and that is that the very legitimate process of collecting intelligence, that involves sources and methods that the analyst needs to know about. In other words, he needs to know whether this is some bartender in Cairo or whether it's some high-level official in the Egyptian government. So the clandestine service, which runs the collection aspect of agent reporting, needs to give the analysts enough information about the source so that they can be confident with respect to what kind of credence to give the provenance of this or that piece of intelligence.
I'm curious, when you talk about politics not entering into analysis, it strikes me that in order to do a proper analysis of the actions of somebody and their motivations, it requires almost an in-their-shoes understanding of their own political motivations. And that takes really a kind of cultural immersion. And it seems to me that it does require your politics to enter into it, because what you believe about what motivates people, what's possible in the world, and what are the moving forces in the world affects what you're able to see.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of the proposition that politics are actually inseparable from analysis? Or maybe you could talk a little bit about why it is that they are separable, if you think that that's the case.
Yeah. Well, they're only separable in analysis in one sense, and that is when people say politics, at least these days, I assume they mean, are you Republican or Democrat, or do you have a political agenda of some kind? Now, in that sense, they have to be separable, because if you're going to do pure, unadulterated analysis, you have to divorce yourself from whatever regime is in power in Washington and just look at the facts and let them lead you where you need to go. Now, do you need to be politically astute to be able to discover, to analyze, and to report on what's going on in London or what's going on in Baghdad? Obviously, you have to be immersed in those politics. You should ideally be someone who'd lived in Baghdad for 10 years and acquired a little bit of the concept that out of which these people think. So politics is essential for that kind of analysis of foreign governments. Where it gets in the way is if you know, for example, that the president wants you to come up with a memorandum that says Iraq has weapons of mass destruction that threaten the United States, that's politics. If you trim your analysis to show that, and the facts don't warrant that conclusion, well, that's the unpardonable sin. And that's the kind of sin that's been committed repeatedly over the last 2 years.
And that the commission of that sin, in your estimation, is a radical departure from what has gone on at the CIA, at least on the analysis side, since its inception. This is a new animal.
I would love to be able to say that. I would love to be able to say yes. But actually, it started under William Casey and his protege, Bobby Gates. When Casey came in with Reagan, he had this mindset. The Soviets were behind everything untoward that happened in the world. The Soviets, interestingly enough, were behind all terrorist acts, according to Bill Casey. So, for example, when the assassination attempt was made on the Pope, who was behind that? Well, Casey knew right off the bat. It had to be the Soviets. He asked my friends who were working on that area to do a memorandum. They pored over the evidence. There was not the shred of evidence indicating Soviet involvement or Bulgarian involvement. It looked like this crazy Acha fella had done it pretty much on his own. So they came up and they told it like it was. Casey tore up that memo, created a little group of four analysts, put them over on another side of the building, gave them the source material and said, "I'm confident that you can do better." And guess what? They came up with the, quote, correct, end quote, answer. The Soviets and Bulgarians were behind it. And guess what? That was the piece of paper that was sent down to the White House. So what I'm saying here is two things. It started with Bill Casey, big time, institutional corruption, institutional cooking of intelligence analysis to the recipe of high policy. And the techniques used, well, you can see them persisting to this day. They're tried and trusted. Look what happened when the Pentagon couldn't get the, quote, correct, end quote, answer to the existence of ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. What did they do? Well, when the agency analysts could see no link at all, they set up their special little off-the-line group, their mini CIA in the bowels of the Pentagon, the Office of Special Plans, and guess what, folks? They came up with the correct answer. There were great ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda going many years back. Of course, there's not a shred of truth to that, but they came up with the right answer, and that was stovepiped right up to Secretary Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and, of course, the President of the United States. So the corruption started back in the early 80s, and I'm very, very sorry to tell you this, but the kinds of people, you know, take those three, four, five people who were set up in the other part of the building to come up with the right answer. Well, those are the senior managers, the CIA now. And so when George Tenet, the director of CIA, comes back from the White House with his instructions, i.e., do a national intelligence estimate that comes up with the same conclusions that Dick Cheney just said in his speech on August 26, 2002. George Tenet doesn't have, well, if someone came back in my day and said, "Well, this is what the White House wants us to do," we would say, give me a break, man. You must be kidding. We're not going to do that kind of thing. That's not our job. But now you've got a bunch of senior managers who are so malleable, who are so used to sniffing which way the wind is blowing and trimming their sails accordingly, that Tenet has no trouble at all. And that, my friends, is what's happened here. That's why there's no real noun to describe the kind of outrage that we veteran intelligence professionals feel as we watch the corruption of something that, believe it or not, is very sacred. This process, if it's going to get anywhere near the truth, has to be pure, and watching it prostituted, and that's not too strong a word, watching it prostituted is a little bit like, it's a little bit like watching somebody you really love being violated.
You mentioned that this intelligence, this cooked intelligence, essentially gets stovepiped to the major policymakers. If the process is initiated by them, and this is what they want to be hearing, then presumably the creation of that intelligence is not really for them. It's for somebody else.
Agreed.
Now, who is it for? At the moment, of course, the whole hullabaloo about WMD and the corporate press is about whether or not the intelligence was flawed and why was the intelligence flawed. And so you could say, well, this is to provide a cover for those policymakers. But in the normal course of business, it never rises to this level. So who is this for? Is this for the people in Congress who allocate the money?
Wow.
But for whom is it?
Well, you're right. Take 2002, for example. We know, everyone knows who's taken a look at things, that the final decision to make war in Iraq was made at the very latest in the spring of 2002. Some people date it back to 9/12/2001, and there's lots of evidence that that's true too. But at the very latest, the plans were set and approved by the president in the spring of 2002. Why do I stress that? Well, the question is, what was the intelligence community saying in the spring of 2002? And guess what? They weren't saying anything. There was no national intelligence estimate. You have to understand that before a major decision is taken in the foreign policy area by our government, particularly a decision on war and peace, always, always, a national intelligence estimate is ordered by the president or someone else, so the intelligence community can pronounce in a coordinated way on what the issues are. And there was no such estimate. Why was there no such estimate? Well, it's very clear to me that if George Tenet, the head of the CIA, had ordered up an estimate like that, it wouldn't have been supportive of the decision to make war in Iraq. Why? Because Iraq was not a danger to the United States or even to its neighbors. Why do I say that? Well, I say that because Colin Powell, on the 24th of February, 2001, said that. He said, Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction and is not even a conventional threat to its neighbors. 24th of February, 2001, I have the videotape. Condoleezza Rice said pretty much the same thing in July of 2001. So how could they do an estimate that would justify plans for war? They couldn't, and so they didn't. And George Tenet, the head of the CIA, kept his head way down, until when? Well, until they realized. They came back from vacation, summer vacation in 2002, and said, okay, we're going to do this war. What's the first thing we have to do? Somebody said, well, oh, bummer. There's this Constitution thing. It says that only Congress can declare war, so I guess we're going to have to persuade Congress. Well, at that point, Congress woke up from its sleep and realized that there was no national intelligence estimate. So Bob Graham, the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, ordered one up. So that estimate, that one that was so wrong, demonstrably wrong, in virtually every major point it made, this estimate, which dovetailed with what Dick Cheney said on the 26th of August in 2002, namely that Saddam Hussein was reconstituting his nuclear weapons program and that UN inspectors were not worth anything, okay? That estimate was prepared in 3 weeks and it was briefed during its preparation to whom? To the Congress. So the answer to your question is that particular piece of intelligence was fashioned so that Congress would be persuaded that there was this great threat from weapons of mass destruction. Now we know there were not any weapons of mass destruction at that time, and the analysis was at best inept, at worst prostituted. The estimate was wrong. The decision to go to war was made irrespective of that estimate and many months before it. And the estimate's purpose was to deceive Congress, was to participate in the administration's attempt to deceive the branch of government that has the constitutional right to send our young men and women off to war, to deceive them into forfeiting that constitutional right and allowing the president to make a war in Iraq. That, my friends, is worse than, the prostitution of intelligence pales in significance next to the prostitution of the constitutional process.
Well, if these cooked intelligence estimates are intended to persuade or deceive Congress, and in this case, if the level of the deception was so apparent and outrageous, it begs the question whether or not Congress actually wanted to be deceived. Because my impression is that from the information that was out there, anybody with an interest in knowing would have known and could have known. I assume that tape of Colin Powell you referred to did not require a security clearance to get access to. I assume that was part of the public record. I also assume that while there is a chain of information flow that's formal, there's also an informal a number of informal channels of information flow, so that it would have been quite possible for anybody interested in the Congress to have determined immediately that this was a deception. So the fact that they were willing to be deceived and then later shocked to find gambling going on in this establishment really begs the question of, how to put it? I'll paraphrase a quote an acquaintance once shared with me, which was that in order to be effective, propaganda has to serve the ulterior motives of the person hearing it. So in this case, what does it mean that Congress was willing to be deceived by such demonstrably false statements?
Well, it's a mite too far to say that they were demonstrably false at that point in time. We veteran intelligence professionals for sanity thought they were largely false, but even we could not bring ourselves to say what some of us felt, that is, quote, there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Now, if this were a foreign country, and we reviewed the information on that foreign country, mostly the mass media, which the media analysis gives you 90% of the answer on many of these things. If that were a foreign country, we would have said those leaders are lying through their teeth. We can see their statements. They're disingenuous. They're deceptive. If they had the information, they would have given it to the UN. These guys don't want the UN to resolve this thing. They want to make a war. That's what we would have said. We had a postmortem a couple of months after all this. And we asked ourselves, now, why were we unable to say that? And the answer was a little embarrassing. It was because there was a major flaw in our analysis. We are, we think, pretty critical, hardcore intelligence analysts, not easily dissuaded, but we were dissuaded. We were dissuaded by the fact that we are Americans, and we could not separate ourselves adequately from the statements of the President of the United States. The President of the United States was saying, there is no doubt. Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, everyone saying, there is no doubt. We have proof positive. And so there was something that just didn't parse. And we just couldn't bring ourselves to believe that the President of the United States would be lying through his teeth to that extent. And so we said, very carefully hedged, we said, there are certainly not enough weapons of mass destruction to warrant an invasion of Iraq, but we think there are probably some left over from earlier on or whatever. We always hedged that. In reality, we should have just done it as though he were a foreign leader and spoken out that way. But in answer to your question, it really comes down to politics. Everyone forgets midterm elections the next month, November 2002. With all the hype, who is going to take the risk of seeming to go against the President of the United States when the country is in mortal danger? Okay? And so this was one of Karl Rove's major coups. He orchestrated this thing, timed it in such a way that it happened in October, and that the votes were very hard for Democrats to vote against this war. I don't defend there. I just have utter contempt for the way some of the Democrats caved in. They should have known better. But political realities are what govern their decisions, and they couldn't let themselves be seen as being soft on, quote, terrorism, end quote, even though Iraq had nothing to do with, quote, terrorism, end quote.
Isn't it interesting that in the lead up to an election, elected officials would be more scared of going against the president than they would be of violating their constitutionally mandated responsibility to declare war and instead sign it over to the president?
It's a very sad commentary.
In the movie Uncovered, in Robert Greenwald's documentary Uncovered, there are several points in it where people express real dismay, almost shock, at the introduction now of the concept of preemptive war. Milt Bearden among them speaks about that. And I think of the invasions of places like Panama and particularly Grenada. And I find myself wondering, was the invasion of Grenada something Well, what was the invasion of Grenada? Let me ask it this way. When we invaded Grenada, what was the nature of the intelligence that was justifying the invasion of Grenada?
Another good question. Grenada came just a little while after the bombing of the Marine barracks in Lebanon. Grenada is a direct result of that. Caspar Weinberger, George Shultz, President Reagan were incredibly embarrassed by leaving so many of our Marines so vulnerable. I think there were over 200 killed that Sunday morning. And they needed to show that the U.S. was no patsy. To their great delight, a ragtag crew took over in Grenada. One or two of them had Cuban connections, and they made the mistake of taking hostage, or at least sequestering some American medical students there at the medical school there in Grenada. The administration knew this to be an opportunity. Grenada was certainly not going to be a threat to our security, but on the pretext of rescuing these, quote, hostages, end quote, the Marines or the 82nd Airborne was sent in. The rationale was to rescue these and rescue Grenada from a Cuban takeover. All that was synthetic. All that was contrived. That had nothing to do with intelligence. As a matter of fact, intelligence 5 hours before the invasion of Grenada revealed to our top policymakers that these new leaders, the people who had taken over in Grenada, had already blinked and said they had given guarantees that nothing untoward would happen to the, quote, medical school hostages, end quote. But that was disregarded. This was, Grenada was pure and simple, an attempt by this administration to regain the initiative and show that we were really strong and powerful. We could work, we could send our troops into an area really quickly and prevail. Of course, we killed a bunch of Cubans. Some of our guys got killed too, but it was judged to be worth the effort because we needed to recoup our self-esteem in the wake of the terrible debacle in Lebanon. Intelligence didn't have anything to do with it.
I'm curious what you think of the use of the term weapons of mass destruction itself. As somebody whose job it was to accurately represent reality and threat in the world, what is your opinion of a catch-all term that lumps nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, and biological weapons?
Well, it's a part and function of an incredibly adept PR effort on the part of this administration. Its PR is unparalleled in the history of the American government. To lump chemical, biological weapons with nuclear weapons, which is the studied attempt done by use of the term weapons of mass destruction, is disingenuous but incredibly effective. Chemical weapons can be useful on a battlefield, but there are very limited usages for it. Biological weapons, very, very dangerous to use, not very much used and not very much understood. But nuclear weapons, well, we all know what nuclear weapons do. Those of us of my generation used to hide under desks in school to prevent ourselves from becoming fallout victims, if you can believe it. So that's really scary. That's the scare tactics there. So all this was very deliberate, to lump nuclear weapons together with these other weapons of less destruction and conjure up this notion that Iraq posed that kind of threat. Why did they do it? Well, Iraq had used chemical weapons. We knew that they had been working on biological weapons, so a case could be made that Iraq might have that capability. Nuclear weapons, nobody believed they had any nuclear weapons. Our own estimates, our official U.S. government estimates, said that they couldn't have a nuclear weapon before the end of the decade, okay? So let's lump them all together and let's scare the American people. Well, all I'll say is that for people to uncritically accept this this slogan, and I mean the Fourth Estate, I mean the press, and this is the sea change I've observed in our body politic, We no longer have a free press. We no longer have a Bernstein and Woodward who would look at this term and say, what does that really mean? What does that really mean? Is this propaganda or is this real discourse? The press missed it, and so did Congress. I mean, Bob Graham, who was the Democrat heading up the Senate Intelligence Committee, and Porter Goss, the Republican heading up the House Intelligence Committee, well, they've given a new meaning to the word oversight. You know, they chair these oversight committees, but they're blindfolded. They don't want to know about these things.
Well, if we fast forward today and we've still got the same Fourth Estate that we had at the time these representations were being made originally, and now there's all this talk of what the intelligence failures were in Iraq, and also now with the 9/11 hearings, what the intelligence failures were there, and it seems to be the general focus in the corporate media. What do you think of the propaganda environment right now? And as we speak now, it's late March of 2004.
Well, the spin is still on. Anyone who comes out and tells the truth, like Paul O'Neill, like Dick Clark, they are not argued against. They are not confronted by other lines of argument. They are denigrated. They are character assassinated. And so what people really need to be aware of now is where do we look for the comeback on these charges? Dick Clark says the president didn't know what he was doing before 9/11, and Condoleezza Rice, his chief advisor, didn't know what she was doing either. They didn't even have a principals meeting until the week before 9/11, despite Dick Clark's urgent protestations that such a meeting needed to take place. And so what I'd ask the American people to be alert for is why? Why was there no meeting at the highest level on terrorism? Why, with all these warnings in the spring and summer of 2001, why was there no meeting called? Why did the president go off to chop wood in Texas for a month? Why was it that Attorney General Ashcroft started flying only in government planes, whereas before he had flown commercial? Why was it that Dick Clark himself told his people not to fly at all if they could possibly avoid it? There was lots of information out there. And what I've been saying for many months now is that there are a host of unanswered questions, And most of the reason that they are unanswered is because the administration refuses to provide the answers, refuses to provide the materials upon which the answers could be gleaned, okay? So that's one thing. But it's not necessary to go into the question about how much the government knew before 9/11, whether perhaps they even knew it and allowed it, that kind of conspiracy theory. I would be very gentle in attacking people who are looking at the unanswered questions. I've learned the hard way. I believe the Warren Commission conclusions on JFK's assassination. I believe the commission that investigated Martin Luther King's assassination. No longer do I believe those two. And so I'm very, very careful not to dismiss people who are looking at these unanswered questions and come up with theories that might sound outlandish in the beginning.
You were talking about the daily briefing, and you were talking about the information that on August 6, 2001, the president received in the daily briefing information of an impending al-Qaeda attack. How unusual was that information? Is there always information about some impending threat, or is there any reason that you believe that that claim was distinctive and should have been dealt with in ways other than it was dealt with?
Well, the setting was this. Throughout the spring and the summer of 2001, there was what people have been referring to as a spike in all the indicators that something really atrocious was being planned by al-Qaeda. There were numerous intelligence briefings. There were numerous calls. Dick Clark was not able to get the real people who could be the movers and shakers interested. He couldn't get them together until the 4th of September, just 1 week before the attack. What was happening was a steady drumbeat of warnings. The president, according to Condoleezza Rice, said that he was getting tired of all this, okay? He's getting tired of all these warnings, okay? What happened on August 6th, it would have been August 5th when the president's daily brief was prepared. What happened that day is that the analysts in the CIA drew up an article which they titled, Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S., okay? I'll say it one more time. Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S. How do I know that? It's been in the New York Times. What else do we know about that? We know that that article talked about hijackings. We know that that article talked about Al-Qaeda types taking flight training within the United States. We know that that article talked about sleeper cells of Al-Qaeda that the FBI is watching in the United States. And there are certain other things we know about that. How do I know that? It's been in the Washington Post, okay? Now, that is the PDB, the President's Daily Brief item, that the administration has refused to give to the commission that's supposed to be investigating 9/11. They say, we never give the President's Daily Brief to anyone. Well, not so. If you look on the web, you'll see instances going back to the Johnson administration where PDBs were given in toto, sometimes sanitized, to the public media on items of great interest like this cause célèbre. So there's no justification at all for the president refusing to admit this PDB into evidence, so to speak. And the only reason that makes sense is that it would show that he was grossly negligent, grossly incompetent in not ordering measures to counter the threat that was explicated in that president's daily brief.
If they had heeded those warnings from the August 6th President's Daily Brief, what might they have done? Has there ever been a similar threat, and has it ever been intercepted?
Sure. There have been several similar threats. The Millennium threat is one that's come up in the hearings here, discussed almost ad nauseum. What they should have done, obviously, if they're talking about hijacking, was to make sure that these repeated warnings were taken seriously. The FAA did not take them seriously. At very least, they could have made sure that the kinds of stringent security precautions that are taken now, as a matter of course, were introduced and introduced quickly. It's not as though the report came on August 6th. This was building up for the whole year. Everybody dropped the ball, and nobody alerted the people who could have prevented this, the people at the airports, the people in security, the people that Dick Clark said could have put this on the news. They had photos of a couple of these fellas that they knew were in country. So many opportunities were missed that I think that people are being unduly careful in saying, well, we can't be sure that we could have prevented 9/11. I think that if the government was working in a reasonable way, 9/11 could surely have been prevented. But what I do say is this. We know enough about what happened on 9/11 and the weeks thereafter and months thereafter to realize that the president and his senior associates decided in a very determined way to use the incredible trauma suffered by the American people to use and to exploit that trauma to do what they had wanted to do from the outset of the administration, and that was to make war on Iraq, to invade Iraq, to take control of that country, to ensure the supply of foreign oil, and to establish military bases from which they could dominate that area to the advantage not only of the United States, but also the State of Israel.
But how radical a departure is that from business as usual in the United States? We do maintain military bases in over 125 of the 192 or so countries of the world. Why should anybody be concerned about this? Is it really a radical departure from what's been going on in the past?
This is a terribly radical departure of what's gone on in the past. Let's look at what happened. They needed a theoretical justification for starting an unprovoked war. They decided to dredge up a new theory. The president began it when he made a speech at West Point. Then Condoleezza Rice put together the strategic document out of the National Security Council in September of 2002. And it talked about preemption. It talked about the U.S. Being hell-bent on preempting any terrorist or other nation from striking at the United States. Okay? Now, we know now that there was nothing to preempt. Okay? There was nothing to preempt. It was known at the time that the danger to the United States was nothing that we needed to preempt. Okay? So let's stop talking about preemptive war. Preemptive war can be justified under certain conditions, under the universal right for self-defense. It's the same thing. If you see somebody just about to attack you, you can attack them first to preempt them from attacking you. That's not what we're dealing with here. What we're dealing with here is something called preventive war. Now, preventive war is the kind of war that Hitler excelled at, okay? The kind of war that is universally, widely condemned internationally by every international body as being illegal under international law.
I heard you mention in your discussions after the movie Uncovered earlier in the week, your own faith. What do you think of the use by the president and his inner circle of their fundamentalist Christian faith in the wars that they've been promoting and in the aggression that they've been engaged in?
Well, I guess outrageous is, again, applicable here. I guess I also have a good bit of outrage with respect to the mainstream religions. Many of my friends put it this way, that the institutional churches and synagogues are riding shotgun for the system. They should know that out of all our faith traditions, justice, truth, and peace are supreme values. That you can't have justice without truth. And you can't have justice without politics. Now, in a church setting, people say, oh, you're getting into politics now. Right. Well, justice without politics is like a skeleton without flesh. Because politics is the form that justice or injustice takes. And if you're not aware of that or you refuse to believe it, then Hitler can very easily build a Third Reich on your piety and your prayers. And that, of course, is exactly what Hitler proceeded to do. And be aware, my friends, that Hitler insisted that every parish in Germany have a working pastor in it, because he saw that kind of stability as very helpful to the objectives that he was pursuing. He actually passed an ordinance requiring that the various dioceses and the various congregations ensure that each little church in Germany, no matter how small, had a working pastor, and they were already running short of clergy in those days. Hitler was confident that he could depend on such people, priests, Lutheran or Catholic, in being a force for stability and not challenging his regime. And you know, the worst part of all this, of course, is that he calculated correctly. And I see a direct parallel here. So what am I saying here? I'm saying that just as in Germany of the 30s, where there was all too few people who would speak out as they saw the coming injustices and persecutions, what we need to do is get back to the pursuit of truth and justice and peace, and get away from this contrived religiosity. The notion that God blesses America, really the imperative mood, God bless America, that the Bush administration started off when this war started, that's a time-honored technique. I mean, Hitler's armies marched off to war with their belt buckles saying, Gott mit uns, God is with us. And you go back to the the Crusades, and on their shields with crosses, they would say, Deus volt, God wills that we do these kinds of things. So it's really a it's really quite outrageous that this kind of thing should be sold in this day and age as something that God favors America, God will bless America, and we are pursuing this in some degree with God's will and with God's blessing.
Where do you think this is all going? I mean, right now there is a rising perception, even in corporate media, that there's been massive lying. Do you think people in the country really care? And what do you think the effect of testimony like Richard Clark's and others is going to be doing, particularly to people now in the Congress who went along with it in the first instance? Is this going to cause a major change, in your opinion?
Well, I think the most important thing is that a couple of our young men and women are being killed every week, more than a couple, in Iraq. The president is prone to make jokes of this by looking under his carpet and under his desk for weapons of mass destruction. I think the American people will gradually feel an appropriate sense of outrage at all that. They will see, if not their own sons and daughters, the sons and daughters of others coming home in caskets or coming home without arms or without legs. And so as it becomes a little bit more clear that 8, 9, 10,000 U.S. military have been severely hurt, in addition to the 600 or so that have been killed, as it becomes clear that literally uncountable Iraqi citizens have been killed, thousands of them, why is it literally uncountable? Well, it's literally uncountable because our satrap, our proconsul there, Paul Bremer, has forbidden the Iraqi authorities to count civilian casualties. As all this becomes a little clearer, I have a basic faith in the American people that they will see this for what it is. My only concern is that they have to be aware. And if it's true that most of them watch Fox TV, I really despair of their becoming aware. Eight months ago, I was on Fox TV, my one and only time. I was supposed to be talking about weapons of mass destruction. The interviewer said, well, Mr. McGovern, you're supposed to be talking about WMD, but we've just completed a poll, and it says that 69% of the American people don't care if WMD are found in Iraq or not. What do you say to that? And I said, well, that's not surprising at all, because the American people haven't been told what's going on, because Fox and other news outlets don't explain these things to them.
Did they air that?
Yeah, well, it was live, so it was my only chance. And the fellow said, oh, so you're blaming Fox? And no, not just Fox. I'm saying Fox and all the other mainstream TV outlets. They don't tell the American people what's going on. And so why should you be surprised that 69% of the American people don't care about something that was adduced as the main reason for our first unprovoked invasion of a foreign country?
You know, there are a lot of people saying that what Bush and this administration have done has actually dramatically increased the odds of terrorist attacks on Americans here and around the world, and that we have ushered in an age of hostility towards America based on imperial aggression from which there will be no pulling out. What is the way out of this cycle of violence?
Well, I think one has to be sensible. One has to look at more than just the symptoms. People talk about how to fight terrorism. Well, you fight terrorism, you counter terrorism or eradicate it the same way you eradicate malaria. Obviously, with malaria, what you do is you station a platoon of riflemen around the swamp and you try to shoot as many mosquitoes as you can find exiting the swamp. I mean, that's very effective, right? Well, give me a break. That's what we're doing on terrorism. The swamp is there. What's the swamp? Well, you just look at Al Jazeera TV for two nights in a row, and you will see U.S.-made attack helicopters target assassinating people in Palestine. You will see U.S.-made Caterpillar bulldozers bulldozing Palestinian homes. You will see all kinds of atrocities committed in the West Bank and Gaza, supposedly in retaliation for suicide bombings in the other direction. I don't condone suicide bombings, but I ask people to think about three generations of Palestinians living in that squalor. I mean, it comes down to this. In 1968, in this country, when Martin Luther King was assassinated and all hell broke loose in Washington, D.C., there were a lot of terrible things happening on 14th Street. Marion Wright Edelman tells a story of walking down that street, seeing a 14-year-old boy with a big boulder ready to throw it through a store window. And she grabs his arm and she says, "Son, don't do that." And he looks up and he says, "Ma'am, why not?" And she said, "Well, think about your future." And he looked up at her and he said, "Ma'am, I ain't got no future." And that's the feeling that you're getting here among the Arabs and the people who see that there's not much future in their area as long as what happens in Israel-Palestine continues to happen, and as long as they see no reasonable redress of their grievances. And, you know, the final analysis, why is Osama bin Laden so popular? Well, one of the things he used to always say is that the United States is interested in invading an Arab country and seizing all the assets that they have and waging this war of the West against Islam. Guess what's happened? The U.S. has done that. So in answer to your question, there's no question. Dick Clark is absolutely right. The world, Spain, Morocco, wherever you look, and the United States is in much more danger from terrorism now than it was before the unprovoked attack on Iraq.
What does this mean to the people within the CIA right now, the analysts who are trying to represent the truth, who are seeing the real implications of all this? What does it mean to them? What are they doing right now? What do you think is happening inside the bowels of that agency?
Well, I guess I would have to confess that one of the most profound disappointments we veteran intelligence professionals have is that no one from the CIA has chosen to speak out. There are literally hundreds of people who know what lies were told. This is why, of course, Karl Rove and the White House clique that decided to release Valerie Plame's name and to out her as a covert CIA employee.
That's the wife of former Ambassador Joe Wilson, who publicly stated that the claims about Niger selling yellowcake uranium to Iraq were hollow claims.
That's correct, yeah. That was their reason for doing that, was to tell anybody else who, like her husband, might be inclined to tell about the lies, to tell them, look, you're going to pay a price. Your record may be clean, but you've got a wife, you've got kids. Maybe one of your kids was on drugs. You got a job. Don't think that you can come out and tell what really happened here. And I'm sorry to say that so far that tactic, however embarrassing it's been to the administration, it's worked. No one from the CIA has come out and spoken out. Have others? To their great credit, three Foreign Service officers quit very early on because they were unwilling to tell the lies. This calls for, you know, rising above petty bureaucratic considerations. And in the agency, I know it so well. I mean, you've got a mortgage, you've got kids in college. Most important, you love the work. The work is incredibly exciting work. It's important work. And so the tendency is to keep your head down, live through this administration so that you can fight the battle again. But the reality is that unless people come out, as they have to me just in these last few days, and say, I know Dick Clark. Dick Clark is a straight shooter. Dick Clark was dedicated to his job. He's a man full of integrity. And I know he's right because A, B, and C I can tell you about. Unless that happens, I will continue to be profoundly disappointed in my former colleagues.
Is there anything you'd like to leave people with that we haven't covered yet?
Yes, I feel very strongly that these coming months will be the most important months in my lifetime with respect to what happens to my country. I was born in August of 1939, 6 days before Hitler sent his troops into Poland. I've lived in Germany for 5 years and had occasion to talk with all manner of Germans. I know a lot about the weeks and the months preceding the beginning of World War II. And I know how the established church and other authorities fell down in their responsibility to face up to the Hitler challenge. I know how the media were subverted and were used by Goebbels and others to further the aims of Hitler. I see so much parallelism here in this situation that it scares me greatly. And I would just say that I feel enough a dispassionate intelligence analyst to say that nothing I've seen in the last several weeks leads me to suspect that I'm overdrawing this situation. The situation is perilous, it's real, and unless the American people somehow, through some media, through some consciousness that perhaps comes of relatives and friends coming back in caskets or wheelchairs, then unless the American people get to realize the enormity, the gravity of the situation, come November, I fear for the future of our country.
Okay, well, I'd really like to thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure.
You're most welcome.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the Internet, via community radio, and as CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD, or you can download it for free at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the digit 4, all.net. If you valued what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, thus becoming yourself part of a decentralized, democratic civic media. Thanks very much for listening.